CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. And we immediately get in our time machine and go to 1789, the early hours of the American Republican experiment. We're looking at the removal debate of 1789 having to do with the powers of the executive itself, as these founders were debating what it is that they have created in their revolution, revolt, civil disorder with Mother Britain. We go to Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, which I learned from Richard, linking to an article by David Alvis and Flag Taylor about the Removal Act. Congress, the Constitution says, and he shall nominate the president, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all the other officers of the United States, whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law. But the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the president alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of department. Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution of the United States. Richard, these dry words begin a debate that we have all the way here till the 21st century and the power of the president. Very good evening to you.
Yes, I mean, what you did was to read aloud an incredible mouthful that most people find it very hard to understand. So I am going to say, at least for the beginning, try to break it down a little bit. It turns out what the Constitution does is it provides for what they call principal offices, and these individuals must be confirmed by the Senate to take their position. Everybody agrees that a principal officer includes all the members of the cabinet with whom the president starts to work. Then there are people who are inferior officers, many of whom can be swung. They could either be done through Senate confirmation or they could be done without it by giving the power to the president to appoint and so forth. The removal debate only talked about it originally a very small part of this complicated appointed structure. And that was the following question. They tell you how it is that you appoint an officer, but they don't tell you how it is that you remove that officer from office. And this is one of the standard features of American constitutionalism, is you put together a constitution and you think it's a reasonably comprehensive document for governance, but there are what Justice Robert Jackson called the great silences in the Constitution, those things that have to be resolved, but the text doesn't give you any warning. And so what happened, there was a debate. And on the one side, there were people who believed that there was a symmetry that was associated with this debate. So if you had to get the Senate in order to approve somebody, the president could not dismiss that person from office unless he could get the approval of the Senate, which would be a complicated procedure. Madison, who was as ever extraordinarily persuasive, says you can't run the situation in that particular fashion. These are offices of trust. And if the president really doesn't see eye to eye with any one of his principal people, it's going to be very difficult for him to delegate authority down to those particular people. So what he said is you can dismiss these people at will, but if you want to then replace them with somebody else permanently, the check that Congress has is they can essentially, or the Senate rather, need not confirm the substitute nominee. And after some debate, it became pretty clearly established that the senior officials with the Madison position would prevail, but there's this whole other galaxy of people who are going to be appointed, and it wasn't exactly clear how they would be treated. There was a famous case called Myers done by Chief Justice William Howard Taft, who had been the president. And what he said, and it's highly controversial, is that the ability of the president to fire at will extends to anybody who is confirmed by the Senate, even though it doesn't extend to those people who are appointed by the president alone, by the courts of law, by the various departments. And so what we do is we have one rule surely for senior officers. We may have a second rule with respect to inferior officers. And then the third major case is what do we do with members of administrative agencies?
The puzzle is that because they established these boundaries in 1789, we go immediately, I'm following your reporting, Richard, because I'm learning here. We go immediately to the 20th century and a very significant Chief Justice, William Howard Taft, who had been a favorite of Teddy Roosevelt's until he became president. But as Chief Justice of the United States, he very carefully leads the opinion of Myers administration versus United States. This is the question of, does the president have the power of inferior officers? And the way the case reads, you linked it for me in the Supreme Court records, the case presents the question whether under the Constitution, pointing to 1789, the president has the exclusive power of removing executive officers of the United States whom he has appointed by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. Now, why did this become a burning issue in 1926? What was happening, Richard?
Well, in 1926, this was essentially a burning issue because everybody saw what was going to come down the road, which did happen 10 years later. What are you going to start to do with administrative agencies? And so Taft gives this exhaustive provision, and he says that even if these guys could have been appointed without senatorial consent, if they'd get it, then the president could fire them. There's a lot of resistance. And then 10 years later, there's a case called Humphrey's Executor, which is decided. So what you're going to do with somebody when the president tries to fire a member of the Federal Trade Commission. And it turned out that the Federal Trade Commission was established as an independent agency under Wilson. It followed the pattern of independent agencies that began with the Interstate Commerce Act and the appointment of the Interstate Commerce Commission back in 1887, which was certainly the biggest deal in that generation in terms of the transformation of American government. And everywhere you looked in the states, these independent commissions had people who could only be removed for cause, very narrowly defined as a kind of misbehavior, but otherwise were there. And Sutherland said, look, when I look at this Constitution, I don't see just an executive branch and a legislative branch and a judicial branch. I see people on the FTC, and they are quasi-judicial and they're quasi-legislative. They make decisions and they also make general rules. He should have added that they were also quasi-executive because they enforce the various rules that they make. So what you did is you put all three branches of government into a single administrative agency, and then you insulate them from removal. And that was upheld. So at that particular point in time, it turns out that there's just this huge exception that one sees to the Myers rule for senior officials with these agencies. And it's not crazy. Essentially, you did want to create independent agencies. So the arguments that Madison made in 1789 about the importance in the removal debate of having the president work with confidants whom he trusts really doesn't carry over very far with respect to a set of executives who are supposed to be independent from his influence. That is, as the Constitution evolved over the 150 years, this became very powerful. Legislatures could do grand things, but as their numbers started to increase and the burdens that they had got ever larger and more things would have to be delegated downward to the president or to the executive branch. People perceived that if you did that and gave everything to the president as an independent party, he might become excessively powerful. And so the independent commission was thought to be a kind of a buffer or a break against that. Now you do have an executive-like agencies, but it's not directly responsible to the president, so they can start to form policy on how it is you broadcast licenses, for example, or telecommunications networks with respect to various messages that go back and forth between people over the wires. That essentially then became the law. And the last stage of this is, suppose you try to create a one-man commission. And in the recent Sadler case, the Supreme Court sort of balked. They said, it's okay to have 3-2, even if we know that the decisive third is appointed by the president. But one-man independent agencies insulated from all control by anybody else, you've gone a step too far. And so if you want to create a one-man agency, the president could remove him at will. And that was exactly what was done with respect to Fannie and Freddie when they held that the one-man executive in the Federal Housing Authority could not do this. And Biden could therefore fire him. So what we do is we have three parts of this structure that we had to worry about. And we have three kind of very different responses. It proves something as the world starts to evolve. First, you put institutions into place. Don't challenge their constitution. constitutionality. And then 50 years later, somebody says, is this constitutional? And it's already established. It's what I've come to call a prescriptive constitution. That is, these practices go on so long that you can't get rid of them any more than you could take away property from somebody who's held it adversely to its own owner for 50 years. And the Constitution has both original institutions on the one hand and these developed institutions, and there's no textual guideline for them. So you get decisions like the one that you saw in the case having to do with Saylor on the one-man commissions. And essentially they said, look, we were willing to go as far as allowing five people situation, but we're not going any further.
All right, let me summarize.
When we make this stuff up, there are limits on what we imagine.
Let me summarize so we can come to the 21st century. Madison and the original founders debate the Removal Act and the power of the presidency. The Taft Court in 1926 declares that the president does have the power, does have these powers to appoint. But the Hughes Court in 1935 under the New Deal unanimously rules that it doesn't extend to all offices, especially inferior officers. Now let's come to the late 20th century, Buckley versus Valeo, 1976, about the Federal Election Commission Campaign Act of 1971, ruling that the president does not have the power to influence the commission that is going to have say over his or his party's future. Was that the hesitation in 76?
Well, it's a very complicated statute, but everybody understands that the elections and their oversight is extremely sensitive. And there was a great deal of nervousness about saying that the president, who was an incumbent, could appoint all the people to the elections commissions. And so what they tried to do in Buckley v. Valeo is to have a situation in which the Speaker of the House and the President pro tem of the Senate, the Vice President, and the President would divide the number of appointments to this body. And the Supreme Court looks at it, and it reads the provision that you read aloud at the beginning, and says this is the exclusive way in which you can make appointments. And so it turns out that there's no way that you could appoint people to these bodies by either a Senate member or the Senate entirely, or by the House or its House leaders. All of this is completely illegal. So what they do is they strike down that kind of commission. They strike it down with respect to people who have office of power under the Constitution. They don't care for these purposes whether they're inferior or principal offices. Essentially what they say is that the appointments clause is the exclusive route through which appointments to high government positions where they actually have executive or administrative power has to be done under that clause.
Your concern in the 21st century, decisions made by the Biden administration about the removal of certain appointments by the Trump administration to boards, advisory boards. In particular, your colleague at the Hoover Institution, H.R. McMaster, retired U.S. Army general, former national security advisor, was appointed to an advisory board at the Academy, West Point Academy. He has been removed by order of the president, and the concern here is H.R. McMaster's appointment to that board, which reads in plain English to extend for 3 years, is that an inferior officer? Is that anything like an inferior officer? Does the president have the power? Your additional concern is this is going to turn into tit for tat, where when the White House changes parties, there's going to be automatic removal of everything done by the previous administration willy-nilly, regardless of the debate that we've had. Have I read you correctly?
Yes, I think there are two issues. There's one, the question is, what's the status of these people? And the second question, is it sound policy, even if the president does have the so-called power for remove, for him to exercise it? This is not just with respect to the service academies. There were committees having to do with fine arts and doing with real estate development. And what Biden has done is taken the position that I'm going to send you a farewell letter, which will have three sentences. The last one says, thank you. But before that, he says, if you don't resign by 6 p.m., I'm going to fire you. No explanation as to where he gets the power or how it is done. You look at the statute, and what it says is these are appointees on a rotating basis, say, but you get two people to appoint as the president for three-year terms. These boards are real composites. That is, they also have people appointed by the head of Speaker of the House and by the president pro tem of the Senate. So the first thing you say, these boards would be completely illegal, given Buckley v. Valeo, if you were actually dealing with officers of the United States, which had administrative power. But the very fact that you can appoint them in this way shows that they're doing something very different. They're acting as advisors to a body. They have no formal power. They're probably not officers of the United States. And so at that point, it turns out they're not caught by the Madison provisions of 1789. There's an explicit contract there for 3 years. There's a very important purpose which is intended to be served, that is to make sure that there's a rotation in office, the idea being that these advisory boards should have somewhat differences in opinion. And if you allow the current president and the current speaker and the current president pro tem of the Senate to remove these guys, then instead of having a variety of opinions, you're going to have one opinion by one man, because as Ms. Psaki said, she says the president wants to have his values reflected. Right. Well, every president wants to do that. He can reflect it in the appointments he makes. But if you do this, they're all gone. I think it's illegal because I think these contracts are binding. I don't think that these people are principal officers of the United States or even inferior officers given the mode of their appointment. And so what happens is the contract binds and there's a perfectly legitimate purpose for having it. So I think they could fight.
We will return to this because I want to speak to you of your experiences in New Zealand and deregulation. This is Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution. This is CBSI on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.